Welcome back. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is called Race, Sport, and Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Hi, Toby.
So we were speaking a couple of days ago with one of your former mentors in Britain, namely Alan Tomlinson, about the World Cup of men's football or men's soccer, depending on how you describe it, and some of the various controversies that are surrounding it. I wondered if you could give us your take on, for instance, some of the struggles we're seeing to do with the expenditure on infrastructure in Brazil towards the World Cup, not necessarily towards social needs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been an interesting example of how sport can be used as a form of social change, but not the type of social change that's often espoused by sports governing bodies and by politicians. I think the process that you saw in Rio and in other cities that were using the Confederations Cup as a way to express angst and alarm at some of the changes to social policies in Brazil, I think is actually a good example of how sport provides a public forum for enabling groups that otherwise wouldn't have a voice within the public sphere to really engage in broader public, political debates. And this despite the kind of claims of organizations like FIFA that that sport leads to social change. Often the social change that they're interested in is more related to forms of economic regeneration, which often has little benefit for the local populations.
And FIFA is the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, which is the world governing body. And yeah, it's the entity that, in a sense, owns the World Cup. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, and it has extraordinary powers, just as the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, does, to actually make host countries and host cities restructure their tax laws. So what you often find with these mega sporting events, such as the World Cup, is that the economic benefits often go to multinational corporations who are able to extract the profit without paying taxes on that profit. So they often have these 30-day, 60-day, 90-day kind of agreements whereby the kind of economic activity that would normally be taxed at the local rates is either free completely from taxation or a much reduced rate. So the power of these sports governing bodies to reshape local economies is really significant.
And they become almost mini-states, don't they? I mean, they operate in some ways with their own international legal systems and with enormous sway over the way in which sovereign entities, sovereign nations, go about their lives and businesses.
Yeah, and the suspension of broader civil rights as well. So one of the things that you'll find is that many of the new forms of surveillance technologies are often practiced and first experimented with these sporting mega events. So as we saw last summer in 2012 with the London Summer Olympic Games, you had this quite extraordinary situation of surface-to-air missiles being put on top of local council estates, like local housing, often almost universally against the wishes of the residents who are actually in these buildings. Quite draconian measures of surveillance, of stopping and searching, so you couldn't even get within a two-mile radius of the Olympic venues themselves without being subject to search, both by private security organizations. So there was a kind of privatization of the security apparatus. But as we've seen in other examples, many of these private companies that come in to do the work that the state was previously doing often can't do the job. So at the last minute, the UK government had to draft in thousands of British soldiers to do the work of securing the Olympic spaces.
So there's a certain complicity on the part of local governments with the loss of sovereignty that comes with the supposed glitz and glamour of these mega sporting events, as you've called them. In terms of economics and culture and social impact, is it worth it having these things? Was it worth it, Montreal hosting the Olympics in 76 or South Africa hosting the Men's World Cup in 2010?
It depends on the measure. So it's true that cities and nations, at least momentarily, have their moment in the spotlight. So last summer, London was, you know, was the city that was hosting the Summer Olympic Games, and its profile and the kind of recognition that it got globally was significant. But you could say, well, everyone knows about London. Like, London doesn't necessarily need the Olympic Games to kind of, you know, boost its profile. And in fact, there is some research, and it's fairly reliable, that shows that the net tourist receipts are often either flat or sometimes they actually decline. In other words, you know, if you wanted to go to London and you're not into sports, then you're not going to go to London during the Olympic Games. So you're actually going to like change your travel patterns. And the extra travel that they do get from fans and from athletes often doesn't kind of compensate for that loss. So what you tend to get is you know, profits for the few and then kind of public austerity for everyone else. And you do see that in, just going back to the London Olympics, which I do know quite a bit about, you've actually seen the closing of local recreational facilities across the UK. So there's a very famous running track in Sheffield, which has just closed down, where Jessica Ennis trained. So one of Britain's leading heptathlons, she won the gold medal in the heptathlon last summer. The Don Valley Stadium where she trained, which kind of made her into or provided a space through which she could become an Olympic champion, has now closed because Sheffield City Council simply don't have the funds to continue to support kind of grassroots recreational forms of sport and leisure. So one of the arguments actually is once the jamboree of the Olympics moves on, what's the legacy? Well, you're left with an Olympic-sized swimming pool, but most people aren't Olympic swimmers, so actually you probably would rather have a much smaller recreational pool that's open, you know, 24/7 than have an Olympic-sized swimming pool that you're really going to use. So on balance, it appears that corporations benefit. The local politicians at both the local and national level, they often benefit, at least when it goes well. The society has, at best, 2 to 3 weeks, maybe a month's worth of jubilation and celebration, but then the price tag is left for the local inhabitants to pay, often for years to come.
What about the argument that says, in terms of public health, fitness and so on, there's a halo effect, a mimesis that comes as a consequence of having elite athletes, that someone like Jessica Ennis then inspires other young women in particular, perhaps also people with mixed cultural, mixed race heritages, as she does, to get involved in sport, and that this then, you know, the argument sometimes goes, reduces unwanted teenage pregnancy or increases educational attainment or, you know, makes people less likely to take up dangerous drugs and so on.
Yeah, there's undoubtedly a short-term boost in the level of interest in sports. But what we have to remember is that most people engage with sports through the TV, you know, through the media, through, you know, increasingly these days, their cell phones. So the actual participation rates longer term, we've had many Olympic Games and many World Cups now to kind of demonstrate this, aren't significantly affected by these big mega events. The latest figures from the UK, for example, have actually showed a decline in the number of people partaking in sports in a significant manner since the Olympics moved on. And as I kind of mentioned before, that if your local sports facilities, often run by your local authority, are closing because of the tightening of budgets, then it doesn't really matter how much you might want to go and participate in, say, swimming or tennis, if there are no freely available or cheaply available facilities to do that. So, sure, now when Andy Murray won the men's Wimbledon title last summer, it was undoubtedly the case that for the next few days and weeks, kids across England were going outside and hitting tennis balls badly across the street. But were they then joining up to, or taking up memberships to often private and fairly expensive tennis clubs around England? No. That's part of the rhetoric that organisations, that host cities rather, and governments often make when they try to bid for these events. But the empirical data just simply doesn't back it up.
And Ben Carrington, I wanted to ask you about some racial questions in the second part of our chat, if I may. Yeah. I'm interested in particular in what you would see as some of the differences between, say, race and sport in the United States versus other parts of the world.
There are clearly different configurations of how race and sport interact in the US as opposed to elsewhere, say in Western Europe. I mean, the US is interesting because it's historically had the most overt forms of racial discrimination, especially in terms of segregation. So, you know, we're famous, and especially with the film that came out earlier this year around Jackie Robinson and the film 47, around the forms of the colour lines that were drawn in various sports. So Jackie Robinson breaking the colour line in baseball in 1947. It seemed to be a momentous moment and kind of predates the civil rights movement, at least how it is traditionally kind of understood as a movement that starts in the 50s and then has successes throughout the 1960s. And then there's a kind of a notion that America solves its racial problems. And often Americans, when they look to Europe and they do see more overt forms of racial abuse, like we've seen in soccer, for example, with players like Italy's black player Mario Balotelli being racially abused during last summer's European Championships and bananas being thrown at black players. So very vicious, ugly forms of anti-black racism still circulate very overtly in many European countries and many European soccer stadiums. Americans then tend to become a bit complacent to say, well, no, no matter how much people may hate LeBron James, he hasn't yet been subjected to monkey chants and bananas being thrown at him on the court. And that's undoubtedly true, but one of the things that's interesting about the American situation is actually how much more complex forms of racism get articulated. And we see it in terms of the difficulties that black players have, for example, African-American players, in moving from the playing field into coaching positions or into senior positions within the organizations of sports. So for the most part, American sports institutions remain, to quote Greg Dyke, who is now in charge of the Football Association in the UK, they remain hideously white. So I think there are still ways in which kind of whiteness and white privilege are maintained in sports, even though on the one hand it's claimed to be this kind of meritocratic space that is free from racism.
And in terms of the black-white binary, that division, that bifurcation that clearly characterises so much of US society, that often, of course, leaves out people who don't quite fit those categories, doesn't it? You know, it doesn't really fit a lot of, but not all, Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, and so forth. And I wonder how they fit into that constellation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So we have this very powerful binary that structures racial discourse and racial discussions in the US, even today, in terms of this being fundamentally a kind of a black-white issue. And of course, given the racial diversity of the US and the different histories of migration, that simply doesn't accord with the existing reality. What's interesting, though, is that many of these other groups are often seen in relation to that kind of that binary. And I think one of the things that you know, commentators, sports journalists, and even academics kind of need to do is to actually to think much more creatively and in a more sophisticated way about those contemporary complexities, especially in the age of mixed race identities. Tiger Woods would be a good example. So Tiger Woods is often read as the first African American, or at least the first African American male golfer to achieve kind of major success over an extended period of time. There's obviously been other African American golfers before Tiger Woods, but Tiger Woods's other racial and ethnic identities, you know, his Asian heritage, the ways in which he himself referred to himself as a Caliban Asian, in which he tried to kind of articulate his white identity, his Asian identity, and his black identity, that tends to get kind of lost in much of the analysis. But in part, that's because forms of anti-black racism are still very dominant in the U.S., and the notion of, you know, the one drop of, you know, black blood defining somebody as being black still has a very kind of powerful material effects in terms of how people are perceived and therefore how they're treated, both in sports and outside of sports.
Sure. I'm conscious that in Britain right now, there is a lot of talk about the difficulty of black and Asian, but especially black managers, getting a fair go in terms of applying for major league jobs. Frequently, commentators there and some advocates and activists refer to the Rooney Rule that the National Football League, the NFL, has here, which is an attempt not to insert affirmative action style quotas, but to ensure that on a voluntary basis but a collective one, owners of NFL teams agree that qualified coaches of colour who apply for senior management jobs will at least be interviewed. And the idea is that that has made some kind of difference at the senior management level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe a good example of maybe one of the differences that you asked me about before. I think there's a greater willingness to discuss race and racism in the US as a contemporary issue compared to the UK, where it's almost impossible to do so. So whenever you have a discussion around race in the UK, it quickly collapses back into a question of class. And it's very hard for there to be a public discussion that acknowledges the existence of racism in the UK. And therefore, it becomes even harder to begin to think about ways in which you could redress certain forms of racial discrimination and inequality. That's not quite the same case in the US, although you could argue that it's changing, especially since the election of Barack Obama and the kind of the elevation of many post-racial discourses. But the Rooney Rule, I think, is a good example of an American attempt to say there is an issue here. We have widespread, you know, we have African-Americans playing football at the college level and then professionally in the NFL in relatively high numbers, and a complete absence of African-American head coaches. And the Rooney Rule has been effective in many ways in terms of opening up the possibilities for African-Americans to become head coaches and actually being appointed. Although that, if you listen to some of the comments from African American head coaches, they're questioning the extent to which it's that the NFL has become a bit complacent. And so there's a way in which the NFL can say, well, we've done the Rooney Rule, we've done all that we need to do. And actually, the opportunities to progress into management and to keep your job, which is crucial, even when there's a downturn. So there's good evidence to suggest that it's actually the black NFL coaches tend to have to be better qualified with more experience before they get appointed compared to the white coaches, and they're more likely to be fired earlier for downturn in performance than the white peers. But at least there's a conversation about that in the US. In the UK, it's very, very hard to even broach this as an issue. And then once it does become an issue, to kind of move it forward. There's not the same kind of institutional will, if you like. There's not even the same type of superficial diversity politics, which does exist in the US, that simply doesn't exist in the UK at the moment.
Ben Carrington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is called Race, Sport and Politics. You've been listening to Background Briefing with me, Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. The producer is Graham Fitzgibbon. Thanks to him. Thanks to you for listening. And for those who want to follow up, you can go to ianmasters.com for the podcast version. And most importantly of all, you'll be relieved to learn, as am I, that Ian Masters will be back tomorrow for another episode of Background Briefing.